Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives and is an important foundational start in understanding the way the economy is set up in the United States and beyond. The author is Ellen Brown, and it is a book that everyone should read. Again, The Web of Debt. In the solution area, we have tapped into a number of sources and resources, in particular the Thrive Movement source and website, thrivemovement.com. We specifically investigated into the top 10 actions, what you can do in terms of solutions. Those, as a brief review, are: 1. Get informed, speak up, and connect with others. 2. Bank locally. 3. Buy and invest responsibly. 4. Join the movement to audit and end the Federal Reserve. 5. Keep the internet fair and open. 6. Support independent media. 7. Support organic, non-GMO farming. 8. Require election and campaign finance reform. 9. Advocate for renewable and free energy. And 10. Take part in critical mass actions. Now, let's look at Forrest Gamble's concept of an economic bill of rights. Historically, Henry Ford said, quote, "It is well enough that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." We are beginning to understand, and Occupy Wall Street looks like the beginning of the revolution. We are beginning to understand that our money is created not by the government, but by banks. Many authorities have confirmed this, including the Federal Reserve itself, and we've gone over it in great detail for many, many shows. The only money the government creates today are coins, which compose less than 1/10,000th of the money supply. Federal Reserve notes, or dollar bills, are issued by Federal Reserve banks, all 12 of which are owned by the private banks in their district. As I've said before, most of our money comes into circulation as bank loans, and it comes with an interest charge attached. According to Marguerite Kennedy, a German researcher who has studied this issue extensively, Interest now composes 40% of the cost of everything we buy. We don't see it on the sales slips, but interest is exacted at every stage of production. Suppliers need to take out loans to pay for labor and materials before they have a product to sell. For government projects, Kennedy found that the average cost of interest is 50%. If the government owned the banks, it could keep the interest and get these projects at half price. That means governments, state and federal, could double the number of projects they could afford without costing the taxpayers a single penny more than we are now paying. This opens up some exciting possibilities, according to Mr. Gamble. Federal and state governments could fund all sorts of things we think we can't afford now, simply by owning their own banks. They could fund something Franklin D. Roosevelt and Martin Luther King dreamt of, an economic bill of rights. In his first inaugural address in 1933, Roosevelt criticized the sort of nearsighted Wall Street greed that precipitated the Great Depression. He said, "They only know the rules of a generation of self-seekers. They have no vision, and where there is no vision, the people perish." Roosevelt's own vision reached its sharpest focus in 1944 when he called for a second Bill of Rights. He said, "This republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable political rights. They were our rights to life and liberty. As our nation has grown in size and stature, however, as our industrial economy expanded, these political rights proved inadequate to assure us equality in the pursuit of happiness." He then enumerated the economic rights he thought needed to be added to the Bill of Rights. They included the right to a job, the right to earn enough to pay for food and clothing, the right of businessmen to be free of unfair competition and domination by monopolies, the right to a decent home, the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to enjoy good health, the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment, the right to a good education. Times have changed since the first Bill of Rights were added to the Constitution in 1791. When the country was founded, people could stake out some land, build a house on it, farm it, and be self-sufficient. The Great Depression saw people turned out of their homes and living in the streets, a phenomenon we are seeing again today. Few people now own their own homes. Even if you have signed a mortgage, you will be in debt, peonage, to the bank for 30 years or so before you can claim the home as your own. Health needs have changed too. In 1791, foods were natural and nutrient rich, and outdoor exercise was built into the lifestyle. Degenerative diseases such as cancer and heart disease were rare. Today, health insurance for some people can cost as much as rent. Then there are college loans, which collectively now exceed $1 trillion, even more than the credit card debt. Students are coming out of universities not just without jobs, but carrying a debt of $20,000 or more on their backs. For medical students and other postgraduate students, it can be $100,000 or more. Again, that's as much as a mortgage with no house to show for it. The justification for incurring these debts was supposed to be that students would get better jobs when they graduated. But now, jobs are scarce. And I'll return to this in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. After World War II, the GI Bill provided returning servicemen with free college tuition, as well as cheap home loans and business loans. It was called the GI Bill of Rights. Studies have shown that the GI Bill paid for itself 7 times over and is one of the most lucrative investments the government ever made. The government could do that again without increasing taxes or the federal debt. It could do it by recovering the power to create money from Wall Street and the financial services industry, which now claim a whopping 40% of everything we buy. Banks acquired the power to create money by default when Congress declined to claim it at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. The Constitution says only that Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the power thereof. The founders left out not just paper money, but checkbook money, credit card money, money market funds, and other forms of exchange that make up the money supply today. All of them are created by private financial institutions, and they all come into the economy as loans with interest attached. So, as we've discussed before, governments, state and federal, could bypass the interest tab by setting up their own publicly owned banks. Banking would become a public utility, a tool for promoting productivity and trade, rather than for extracting wealth from the debtor class. Congress could go further. It could reclaim the power to issue money from the banks and fund its budget directly. It could do this, in fact, without changing any laws. Congress is empowered to coin money, and the Constitution sets no limits on the face amount of the coins. Congress could issue a few $1 trillion coins, deposit them in an account, and start writing checks. And that's just one possible example. The Fed's own figures show that the money supply has shrunk by $3 trillion since 2008. That sum could be spent into the economy without inflating prices. $3 trillion could go a long way toward providing the jobs and social services necessary to fulfill an economic bill of rights. Guaranteeing employment to anyone willing and able to work would increase the GDP, allowing the money supply to expand even further without inflating prices, since supply and demand would increase together. In a sense, we need to modernize the Bill of Rights. As Bob Dylan said, the times, they are a-changing. Revolutionary times call for revolutionary solutions and an updated social contract. Apple and Microsoft update their programs every year. We are trying to fit a highly complex modern monetary scheme into a constitutional framework that is 200 years old. After President Roosevelt died in 1945, his vision for an economic bill of rights was kept alive by Martin Luther King. True compassion, King declared, is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Martin Luther King, too, has now passed away, but his vision has been carried on by a variety of money reform groups. The government, as employer of last resort, guaranteeing a living wage to anyone who wants to work, is a basic platform of modern monetary theory, the MMT. A student of MMT declares on his website that by ending the enormous unearned profits acquired by means of privatization of our sovereign currency, it is possible to have truly full employment without causing inflation. Again, it's by ending the enormous unearned profits acquired by the means of privatization of our sovereign currency. Now, what was sufficient for a simple agrarian economy does not provide an adequate framework for freedom and democracy today. We need an economic bill of rights, and we need to end the privatization of the national currency. Only when the privilege of creating the national money supply is returned to the people can we have a government that is truly of the people, by the people, and for the people. So let's look at the global debt crisis, how we got in it, and how to get out. Countries everywhere are facing debt crises today, precipitated by the credit collapse of 2008. Public services are being slashed and public assets are being sold off in a futile attempt to balance budgets that can't be balanced because the money supply itself has shrunk. Governments usually get the blame for excessive spending, but governments did not initiate the crisis. the collapse was in the banking system and in the credit that it is responsible for creating and sustaining. Contrary to popular belief, most of our money today is not created by governments. It is created by private banks as loans. The private system of money creation has grown so powerful over the centuries that it has come to dominate governments globally. But the system contains the seeds of its own destruction. The source of its power is also a fatal design flaw. The flaw is that the banks advance bank credit that must be paid back with interest, while having no obligation to spend the interest they collect so the borrowers can earn it again and again, as they must in order to retire the debt. Instead, this money is invested in various casinos beyond the borrower's reach. This leads to a continual systemic need for more new bank credit money, more debt with more interest attached, to prevent widespread default and deflationary collapse. Today, this problem is particularly evident in the European Union. The euro is a fixed currency system that does not allow for expansion to meet the demands for the private lending casino. The result is that the euro member nations collectively are being crippled by debt. There are more sustainable ways to run a banking and credit system, as we will look into. So just by way of review, the process by which banks create money was explained in the Chicago Federal Reserve in a booklet called Modern Money Mechanics. It states, quote, "The actual process of money creation takes place primarily in banks. Banks do not really pay out loans from the money they receive as deposits. If they did this, no additional money would be created. What they do when they make loans is accept promissory notes in exchange for credits to the borrower's transaction accounts. Loans, which are assets, and deposits, or liabilities, both rise by the same amount. With a uniform 10% reserve requirement, a $1 increase in reserves would support $10 of additional transaction accounts. A $100 deposit supports a $90 loan, which becomes $90 deposit in another bank, which supports an $81 loan, etc. That's the conventional model, but banks actually create the loans first. Picture how a credit card works. Banks need deposits to clear their outgoing checks, but they find the deposits later. Banks create money as loans, which become checks, which go into the other banks. Then, if needed to clear the checks, they borrow the money back from the other banks. In effect, they borrow back the money they just created, pocketing the spread between the interest rates as their profit. The rate at which banks can borrow from each other in the U.S. today, the Fed funds rate, is an extremely low 0.2%. And more of a review, the current system of privately issued money is traced in modern money mechanics to the 17th century goldsmiths. As we discussed before, people who left gold with the goldsmiths for safekeeping would be issued paper receipts for it called banknotes. Other people who wanted to borrow money were also happy to accept paper banknotes in place of gold, since the notes were safer and more convenient to carry around. The sleight of hand came in when the goldsmiths discovered that people would come for their gold only about 10% of the time. That meant that up to 10 times as many notes could be printed and lent as the goldsmiths had gold. 90% of the notes were basically counterfeited. This system was called fractional reserve banking and was institutionalized when the Bank of England was founded in 1694. The bank was allowed to lend its own banknotes to the government, forming the national money supply. Only the interest on the loans had to be paid. The debt was rolled over indefinitely. That is still true today. The U.S. federal debt is never paid off, just continues to grow, forming the basis of the U.S. money supply. And I'll be back in a moment with this. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's look at the public banking alternative. There are other ways to create a banking system, ways that would eliminate its Ponzi scheme elements and make the system sustainable. One solution is to make the loans interest-free, but for Western economies today, that transition could be difficult. Another alternative is for banks to be publicly owned, as we discussed. If the people collectively own the bank, the interest and profits go back to the government and the people, who benefit from decreased taxes, increased public services, and cheaper public infrastructure. Cutting out interest has been shown to reduce the cost of public projects by 30 to 50%. In the United States, this system of publicly owned banks goes back to the American colonists. The best of the colonial models was in Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania, where the government operated a land bank. Money was printed and lent into the community. It recycled back to the government and could be lent and re-lent. The system was mathematically sound because the interest and profits were returned to the government, which then spent the money back into the economy in place of taxes. Private banks, by contrast, generally lend their profits back into the economy or invest in private money-making ventures, in which more is always expected back than was originally invested. During the period that the Pennsylvania system was in place, the colonists paid no taxes except excise taxes, prices did not inflate, and there was no government debt. The Pennsylvania system was sustainable, but some early American colonial governments just printed and spent, inflating the money supply and devaluing the currency. The British merchants complained, prompting King George II to forbid the colonists to issue their own money. Taxes had to be paid to England in gold. That meant going into debt to the English bankers. The result was a massive depression. The colonists finally rebelled and went back to issuing their own money, precipitating the American Revolution. In an international first, the colonists funded a war against a major power with mere paper receipts and won, but the British counterattacked by waging a currency war. They massively counterfeited the colonists' paper money at a time when this was easy to do. By the end of the war, the paper script was virtually worthless. After it lost its value, the colonists were so disillusioned with paper money that they left the power to issue it out of the U.S. Constitution. Meanwhile, Alexander Hamilton, the first U.S. Treasury Secretary, was faced with huge war debts, and he had no money to pay them. He therefore resorted to the ruse used in England known as fractional reserve banking. By 1791, Hamilton set up the first U.S. bank, a largely private bank that would print banknotes backed by gold and lend them to the government. The ruse worked. The paper banknotes expanded the money supply, the debts were paid, and the economy thrived. But it was the beginning of a system of government funded by debt to private bankers who lent banknotes only nominally backed by gold. During the American Civil War, President Lincoln avoided a crippling war debt by returning to the system of government-issued money of the American colonists. He issued U.S. notes from the Treasury called greenbacks, rather than borrowing at usurious interest rates. But, as we know, Lincoln was assassinated, and greenback issuance was halted. In 1913, the privately owned Federal Reserve was authorized to issue its own Federal Reserve notes as the national currency. These notes were then lent to the government, eliminating the government's own power to issue money, except for coins. The Federal Reserve was set up to prevent bank runs, but 20 years later, we had the Great Depression, the greatest bank run in our history. Robert H. Hemphill, credit manager of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, wrote in 1934, quote, "We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. End quote. For the bankers, however, it was a good system. It put them in control. Professor Carol Quigley was an insider groomed by the international bankers. He wrote in Tragedy and Hope in 1966, quote, "The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans. The debt trap was set in stages. In 1971, the dollar went off the gold standard internationally. Currencies were unpegged from gold and allowed to float in currency markets, competing with other currencies, making them vulnerable to speculation and manipulation. In 1973, a secret agreement was entered into in which the OPEC countries would sell oil only in dollars and the price of oil would be dramatically increased. By 1974, oil prices had increased by 400% from 1971 levels. Countries lacking oil had to borrow dollars from U.S. banks. In 1981, the Fed funds rate was raised to 20%. At 20% compound interest, debt doubles in under 4 years. As a result, most of the world became crippled by debt. By 2001, developing nations had repaid the principal originally owed on their debts 6 times over, but their total debt had quadrupled because of interest payments. When debtor nations could not pay the banks, the International Monetary Fund stepped in with loans with strings attached. The debtors had to agree to austerity measures, including cutting social services, privatizing banks and public utilities, opening markets to foreign investors, letting currencies float. Today, austerity measures are being imposed not just in developing countries, but in the European Union and on U.S. states. What Professor Quigley foretold about the Bank of International Settlements has also come to pass. The BIS now has 55 member nations and heads the global financial pyramid. The power of the BIS was seen in 1988 when it raised the capital requirement of its member banks from 6% to 8% in an accord called Basel I. The result was to cripple the Japanese banks, which until then were the world's largest creditors. Japan entered a recession from which it has not yet recovered. U.S. banks managed to escape by dodging the capital requirement. They did this by moving loans off their books, bundling them up as securities, and selling them to investors. To persuade the investors to buy them, these mortgage-backed securities were protected against default with derivatives, which were basically just bets. The protection seller collected a premium for agreeing to pay in the event of default. The protection buyer bought the premium. Owning the asset was not required. Like gamblers at a horse race, derivative players could bet without owning a horse. Derivatives became a very popular form of gambling. The result was the mother of all bubbles, exceeding $500 trillion by the end of 2007. Because of securitization and derivatives, credit mushroomed. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.